Chapter 12. In the late high winds I was blown to a great many places, and indeed, wind or no wind, I generally have extensive transactions on hand in the article of air, but I have not been blown to any English place lately, and I very seldom have blown to any English place in my life, where I could get anything good to eat and drink in 5 minutes, or where, if I sought it, I was received with a welcome. This is a curious thing to consider. But before, stimulated by my own experiences, and the representations of many fellow travelers of every uncommercial and commercial degree, I consider it further, I must utter a passing word of wonder concerning high winds. I wonder why metropolitan gales always blow so hard at Walworth. I cannot imagine what Walworth has done to bring such windy punishment upon itself, as I never fail to find recorded in the newspapers, when the wind has blown at all hard. Brixton seems to have something on its conscience. Peckham suffers more than the virtuous Peckham might be supposed to deserve. The howling neighborhood of Deptford figures largely in the accounts of the ingenious gentlemen who are out in every wind that blows, and to whom it is an ill high wind that blows no good. But, there can hardly be any Walworth left by this time. It must surely be blown away. I have read of more chimney stacks and house copings coming down with terrific smashes at Walworth, and of more sacred edifices being nearly, not quite, blown out to sea from the same accursed locality, than I have read of practiced thieves with the appearance and manners of gentlemen, a popular phenomenon which never existed on earth out of fiction and a police report. Again, I wonder why people are always blown into the Surrey Canal, and into no other piece of water. Why do people get up early, and go out in groups, to be blown into the Surrey Canal? Do they say to one another, "Welcome death," so that we get into the newspapers? Even that would be an insufficient explanation, because even then they might sometimes put themselves in the way of being blown into the Regent's Canal, instead of always saddling Surrey for the field. Some nameless policeman who is constantly, on the slightest provocation, getting himself blown into this same Surrey Canal. Will Sir Richard Mayne see to it, and restrain that weak-minded and feeble-bodied constable? To resume the consideration of the curious question of refreshment. I am a Briton, and, as such, I am aware that I never will be a slave, and yet I have latent suspicion that there must be some slavery of wrong custom in this matter. I travel by railroad. I start from home at 7 or 8 in the morning, after breakfasting hurriedly. What with skimming over the open landscape, what with mining in the damp bowels of the earth, what with banging, booming and shrieking the scores of miles away, I am hungry when I arrive at the refreshment station where I am expected. Please to observe, expected. I have said, I am hungry. Perhaps I might say, with greater point and force, that I am to some extent exhausted, and that I need in the expressive French sense of the word to be restored. What is provided for my restoration? The apartment that is to restore me is a wind trap, cunningly set to inveigle all the drafts in that countryside, and to communicate a special intensity and velocity to them as they rotate into hurricanes. 1. About my wretched head. 1. About my wretched legs. The training of the young ladies behind the counter who are to restore me has been from their infancy directed to the assumption of a defiant dramatic show that I am not expected. It is in vain for me to represent to them by my humble and conciliatory manners that I wish to be liberal. It is in vain for me to represent to myself, for the encouragement of my sinking soul, that the young ladies have a pecuniary interest in my arrival. Neither my reason nor my feelings can make head against the cold glazed glare of eye with which I am assured that I am not expected and not wanted. The solitary man among the bottles would sometimes take pity on me if he dared, but he is powerless against the rights and mights of woman. Of the page I make no account, 4, he is a boy, and therefore the natural enemy of creation.
Chilling fast, in the deadly tornadoes to which my upper and lower extremities are exposed, and subdued by the moral disadvantage at which I stand, I turn my disconsolate eyes on the refreshments that are to restore me. I find that I must either scald my throat by insanely ladling into it, against time and for no wager, brown hot water stiffened with flour, or I must make myself flaky and sick with cranberry cake, or I must stuff into my delicate organization a current pincushion which I know will swell into immeasurable dimensions when it has got there. Or, I must extort from an iron-bound quarry, with a fork, as if I were farming an inhospitable soil, some glutinous lumps of gristle and grease, called pork pie. While thus forlornly occupied, I find that the depressing banquet on the table is, in every phase of its profoundly unsatisfactory character, so like the banquet at the meanest and shabbiest of evening parties, that I begin to think I must have brought down to supper the old lady unknown, blue with cold, who is setting her teeth on edge with a cool orange at my elbow, that the pastry cook who has compounded for the company on the lowest terms per head is a fraudulent bankrupt, redeeming his contract with the stale stock from his window, that, for some unexplained reason, the family giving the party have become my mortal foes, and have given it on purpose to affront me. Or, I fancy that I am breaking up again, at the evening conversation at school, charged 2 and 6 pence in the half year's bill, or breaking down again at that celebrated evening party given at Mrs. Bogle's boarding house, when I was a boarder there, on which occasion Mrs. Bogle's was taken in execution by a branch of the legal profession who got in as the harp, and was removed with the keys and subscribed capital to a place of durance, half an hour prior to the commencement of the festivities. Take another case. Mr. Grazinglands, of the Midland Counties, came to London by railroad one morning last week, accompanied by the amiable and fascinating Mrs. Grazinglands. Mr. G. is a gentleman of a comfortable property, and had a little business to transact at the Bank of England, which required the concurrence and signature of Mrs. G. Their business disposed of, Mr. and Mrs. Grazinglands viewed the Royal Exchange, and the exterior of St. Paul's Cathedral. The spirits of Mrs. Grazinglands then gradually beginning to flag, Mr. Grazinglands, who is the tenderest of husbands, remarked with sympathy, "Arabella, my dear, fear you are faint." Apostrophe Mrs. Grazinglands replied, "Alexander, I am rather faint, but don't mind me, I shall be better presently." Apostrophe touched by the feminine meekness of this answer, Mr. Grazinglands looked in at a pastry cook's window, hesitating as to the expediency of lunching at that establishment. He beheld nothing to eat but butter in various forms, slightly charged with jam, and languidly frizzling over tepid water. 2 ancient turtle shells, on which was inscribed the legend, "Soups," apostrophe decorated a glass partition within, enclosing a stuffy alcove, from which a ghastly mockery of a marriage breakfast spread on a rickety table warned the terrified traveler. An oblong box of stale and broken pastry at reduced prices, mounted on a stool, ornamented the doorway, and 2 high chairs that looked as if they were performing on stilts, embellished the counter. Over the whole, a young lady presided, whose gloomy haughtiness as she surveyed the street, announced a deep-seated grievance against society, and an implacable determination to be avenged. From a beetle-haunted kitchen below this institution, fumes arose, suggestive of a class of soup which Mr. Grazinglands knew, from painful experience, enfeebles the mind, distends the stomach, forces itself into the complexion, and tries to ooze out at the eyes. As he decided against entering, and turned away, Mrs. Grazinglands, becoming perceptibly weaker, repeated, "I am rather faint, Alexander, but don't mind me." Apostrophe urged to new efforts by these words of resignation, Mr. Grazinglands looked in at a cold and flowery baker's shop, where utilitarian buns unrelieved by a current, consorted with hard biscuits, a stone filter of cold water, a hard pale clock, and a hard little old woman with flaxen hair, of an undeveloped farinaceous aspect, as if she had been fed upon seeds. He might have entered even here, but for the timely remembrance coming upon him that Jerrings was but round the corner. Now, Jerrings being an hotel for families and gentlemen, in high repute among the Midland counties, Mr. Grazinglands plucked up a great spirit when he told Mrs. Grazinglands she should have a shop there. That lady, likewise, felt that she was going to see life. Arriving on that gay and festive scene, they found the second waiter, in a flabby undress, cleaning the windows of the empty coffee room, and the first waiter, denuded of his white tie, making up his cruets behind the post office directory. The latter, who took them in hand, was greatly put out by their patronage, and showed his mind to be troubled by a sense of the pressing necessity of instantly smuggling Mrs. Grazinglands into the obscurest corner of the building. This slighted lady, who is the pride of her division of the county, was immediately conveyed, by several dark passages, and up and down several steps, into a penitential apartment at the back of the house, where five invalided old plate warmers leaned up against one another under a discarded old melancholy sideboard, and where the wintry leaves of all the dining tables in the house lay thick. Also, a sofa, of incomprehensible form regarded from any softened point of view, murmured bed. Apostrophe while an air of mingled fluffiness and heel tips, added, second waiters. Apostrophe secreted in this dismal hold, objects of a mysterious distrust and suspicion, Mr. Grazinglands and his charming partner waited 20 minutes for the smoke, for it never came to a fire, 25 minutes for the sherry, half an hour for the tablecloth, 40 minutes for the knives and forks, 3/4 of an hour for the chops, and an hour for the potatoes. On settling the little bill, which was not much more than the day's pay of a lieutenant in the Navy, Mr. Grazinglands took heart to remonstrate against the general quality and cost of his reception. To whom the waiter replied, substantially, that Jerrings made it a merit to have accepted him on any terms. For, apostrophe added the waiter, unmistakably coughing at Mrs. Grazinglands, the pride of her division of the county, when individuals is not staying in the house, their favors is not as a rule looked upon as making it worth Mr. Jerrings' while, nor is it, indeed, a style of business Mr. Jerring wishes. Apostrophe finally, Mr. and Mrs. Grazinglands passed out of Jerrings' hotel for families and gentlemen, in a state of the greatest depression, scorned by the bar, and did not recover their self-respect for several days. Or take another case. Take your own case. You are going off by railway, from any terminus. You have 20 minutes for dinner, before you go. You want your dinner, and like Dr. Johnson, sir, you like to dine. You present to your mind a picture of the refreshment table at that terminus. The conventional shabby evening party supper accepted as the model for all termini and all refreshment stations, because it is the last repast known to this state of existence, of which any human creature would partake, but in the direst extremity sickens your contemplation, and your words are these: I cannot dine on stale sponge cakes that turn to sand in the mouth. I cannot dine on shining brown patties, composed of unknown animals within, and offering to my view the device of an indigestible starfish in leaden pie crust without. I cannot dine on a sandwich that has long been pining under an exhausted receiver. I cannot dine on barley sugar. I cannot dine on toffee. Apostrophe, you repair to the nearest hotel, and arrive, agitated, in the coffee room. It is a most astonishing fact that the waiter is very cold to you. Account for it how you may, smooth it over how you will, you cannot deny that he is cold to you. He is not glad to see you. He does not want you. He would much rather you hadn't come. He opposes to your flushed condition and immovable composure. As if this were not enough, another waiter, born, as it would seem, expressly to look at you in this passage of your life, stands at a little distance, with his napkin under his arm and his hands folded, looking at you with all his might. You impress on your waiter that you have 10 minutes for dinner, and he proposes that you shall begin with a bit of fish which will be ready in 20. That proposal declined. He suggests as a neat originality a Wheeler mutton cutlet. Apostrophe you close with either cutlet, anything. He goes, leisurely, behind a door and calls down some unseen shaft. A ventriloquial dialogue ensues, tending finally to the effect that wheel only is available on the spur of the moment. You anxiously call out, veal then. ... Your waiter, having settled that point, returns to array your tablecloth, with a table napkin folded cocked hat-wise, slowly, for something out of window engages his eye, a white wine glass, a green wine glass, a blue finger glass, a tumbler, and a powerful field battery of 14 casters with nothing in them, or at all events which is enough for your purpose with nothing in them that will come out. All this time, the other waiter looks at you with an air of mental comparison and curiosity now, as if it had occurred to him that you are rather like his brother. Half your time gone, and nothing come but the jug of ale and the bread. You implore your waiter to see after that cutlet. Waiter, pray do. ... He cannot go at once, for he is carrying in 17 pounds of American cheese for you to finish with, and a small landed estate of celery and watercresses. The other waiter changes his leg, and takes a new view of you, doubtfully now, as if he had rejected the resemblance to his brother, and had begun to think you more like his aunt or his grandmother. Again you beseech your waiter with pathetic indignation to see after that cutlet. ... He steps out to see after it, and by, when you are going away without it, comes back with it. Even then, he will not take the sham silver cover off, without a pause for a flourish, and a look at the moldy cutlet, as if he were surprised to see it, which cannot possibly be the case. He must have seen it so often before. A sort of fur has been produced upon its surface by the cook's art, and in a sham silver vessel staggering on 2 feet instead of 3, is a cutaneous kind of sauce of brown pimples and pickled cucumber. You order the bill, but your waiter cannot bring your bill yet, because he is bringing, instead, 3 flinty-hearted potatoes and 2 grim head of broccoli, like the occasional ornaments on area railings, badly boiled. You know that you will never come to this pass, any more than to the cheese and celery, and you imperatively demand your bill. But, it takes time to get, even when gone for, because your waiter has to communicate with a lady who lives behind a sash window in a corner, and who appears to have to refer to several ledgers, before she can make it out, as if you had been staying there a year. You become distracted to get away, and the other waiter, once more changing his leg, still looks at you but suspiciously now, as if you had begun to remind him of the party who took the great coats last winter. Your bill at last brought and paid, at the rate of 6 pence a mouthful, your waiter reproachfully reminds you that attendance is not charged for a single meal, ... and you have to search in all your pockets for 6 pence more. He has a worse opinion of you than ever, when you have given it to him, and lets you out into the street with the air of one saying to himself, as you cannot again doubt he is, I hope we shall never see you here again. ... Or, take any other of the numerous traveling instances in which, with more time at your disposal, you are, have been, or may be, equally ill-served. Take the old established bull's head with its old established knife boxes on its old established sideboards, its old established flew under its old established four post bedsteads in its old established airless rooms, its old established frowsiness upstairs and downstairs, its old established cookery, and its old established principles of plunder. Count up your injuries, in its side dishes of ailing sweetbreads in white poultices, of apothecaries powders in rice for curry, of pale stewed bits of calf ineffectually relying for an adventitious interest on forcemeat balls. You have had experience of the old established bull's head stringy fowls, with lower extremities like wooden legs, sticking up out of the dish. Of its cannibalic boiled mutton, gushing horribly among its capers, when carved. Of its little dishes of pastry roofs of spermaceti ointment, erected over half an apple or four gooseberries. Well for you, if you have yet forgotten the old established bull's head fruity port, whose reputation was gained solely by the old established price the bull's head put upon it, and by the old established air with which the bull's head set the glasses and doilies on, and held that liquid gout to the 3 and 6 penny wax candle, as if its old established color hadn't come from the dyers. Or lastly, take to finish with, two cases that we all know, every day. We all know the new hotel near the station, where it is always gusty, going up the lane which is always muddy, where we are sure. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.